Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. I know we've got a few brand new faces. Raise your hand if you're here for the very first time. Great, okay. It's the job of all the rest of us to make them feel welcome and at home. So please extend our hospitality. We are an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that have been, people before my time, but as an institution, we've been putting on this kind of programming for 35 years running, which is pretty remarkable for such a shoestring operation. And our mission is quite simply to bring topics of philosophical import before the interested lay public so that they can be absorbed and considered. And so we bring as diverse a selection of worldviews as we possibly can. We don't focus on one particular area or one particular worldview. And our format is that we have a lecture for 45 to 60 minutes, to the speaker's preference. And during that time, we ask that you hold your questions and comments, but we will reserve about half an hour at the end to engage the speaker with questions. I'll moderate and recognize the questioners, and we do ask that you phrase a question for the speaker and not editorialize. It's okay to preface a little bit, but I may call for the question if it goes on too long. That's about the only real ground rule we have. Well, another ground rule is to be civil and considerate of each other and of the speakers, because it's okay to disagree, but disagreements don't have to become disagreeable. So that's probably pretty much it for ground rules. We will have Paul Tobolowsky will be speaking to us in 2 weeks. Paul's here tonight, so hope to see everybody back for that, talking something about neuroscience. Some topic in that area. What is it?
About mind and brain.
Mind and brain. Okay, sure. Great. Mind-brain issues come back in 2 weeks. But tonight we have Dr. Jean Pazes from the philosophy faculty at SMU. And she has been on that faculty for 25 years or so. Before that, did her undergraduate work at Penn State University and her PhD work at University of Arizona, and lectures primarily in the area of moral theory recently. And she's coming to us with a topic that is diverse as we've been. I don't think we've ever had anything on this topic, which sounds quite interesting, which is the philosophy of parental love, our children, ourselves. So let's welcome Dr. Pazes.
Thank you very much. Does it just automatically?
You're on.
Okay. So I'm going to be talking about parental love, and I guess I should say something about, why do I get to talk about this? Like, what are my credentials to talk about parental love? I'm working on a book called The Philosophical Parent. It's almost done. It's about the various philosophical issues that people run into throughout the course of becoming and being parents. And once I finished this whole book, I was asked to write a little essay about parental love. And then it occurred to me there really wasn't a chapter about love in the, out of all 18. But there are some ideas about love that kind of naturally come out of the book. So what else should I say about myself? Well, I teach a course on procreation and parenthood at SMU. And I have two children who have recently gone off to college. So I have sort of some understanding of parental love, firsthand. So, okay, well, getting on with it here. So I'm going to be talking about three different topics. So to sort of keep track of where we are in the talk, let me just give you the outline. I'm first going to be arguing that parental love has some striking features. So I will go into those features at some length. I'm then going to offer an explanation of why parental love has those features. And then third, I'm going to discuss whether my explanation is attractive or unattractive. So is it helpful, or does it give us some good guidance about parenthood, or does it, is it sort of dangerous? Is it explanatory, or is it sort of unnecessary? So we'll sort of assess my explanation in the third part of the talk. Okay, so to begin with, let's talk about the striking features of parental love. What are the striking features? Oh, sorry, first of all, what I'm going to do is compare parental love to romantic love, okay? And so the striking features will sort of come out with that comparison. So first thing that seems clear is that parental love is especially groundless. So when you have a baby and you love that baby, it is definitely not because of the features of the baby. It's not because the baby is beautiful. You may think so, but it's not really because the baby is beautiful. In fact, the baby may have really no feature. You know, you may not really understand the baby's attributes, and you can be, nevertheless, you know, in love with the baby. So let me just quote from a philosopher I like a lot, Harry Frankfurt, who makes this point about groundlessness. And actually, I should say that several points I'll be making are kind of inspired by this lovely book called Reasons of Love by Frankfurt. If you want to read more about love, this is a great little book. Okay, so he says, I can declare with unequivocal confidence that I do not love my children because I'm aware of some value that inheres in them, independent of my love for them. The fact is that I loved them even before they were born, before I had any especially relevant information about their personal characteristics or their personal merits and virtues. Furthermore, I do not believe that the valuable qualities they do happen to possess, strictly in their own rights, would really provide me with a very compelling basis for regarding them as having greater worth than many other possible objects of love that, in fact, I love much less. It is quite clear to me that I do not love them more than other children because I believe they are better. Okay, so I'm not the only one who has this sort of sense of the groundlessness of our love for our children. Now, of course, there are exceptions. So everything I say about parental love, you'll be able to think of some exception. And it so happens while I was sort of putting together this talk yesterday, I sort of came across a really glaring exception. There was an article in the New York Times about ugliness and about how parents don't really, the person was trying to argue that we should be more honest about ugliness. And they had a little anecdote about a child who was so ugly that the parents just didn't bring them home until they were five months old, at which point the child's siblings voted and decided, let's bring the baby home. So ugliness was a problem for those parents. But I think that's an exception, and on the whole, the love people have for the children is really not grounded in anything. Okay, next thing. So parental love is especially groundless. Next point is that parental love is more transitive. Okay, now what do I mean by that? I'm not really using the word transitive in its sort of official logical sense, but an interesting thing about love is that when you love somebody, you love what they love. If you sort of look back on, if you love somebody, if you have been married or have a partner or whatever, if you look back on the time when you first met, it seems like, if I'm at all typical, you go through this period of sort of acid tests. You ask them, well, do you love this? You know, do you love that? Now, if the person loves the right things, then you can kind of go forward. But there can also be deal breakers. So, for example, I was once, before I met my husband, I dated somebody who wanted to take me to a monster truck rally. You know, not good, not good. Now, that's kind of a deal, you know, because when you love somebody, you kind of, it involves loving what they love. I cannot love monster truck rallies. Another example, now that's bearing my soul and revealing things that may not be pretty, but I did have this boyfriend once, a long time ago, who would make sandwiches with, you know, white bread and mayonnaise, and that's just, I don't know, that's maybe kind of a Jewish thing, but maybe he had giant fluffy white bread in the kitchen. No, that's just kind of a weird thing, too different. So anyway, so um, So, but when you do love somebody, and there's a certain amount of stuff they love that you can love, then it expands. And as you find out that they love something, you start to love even more things. So, for example, before I met my husband, I cannot say that I was particularly a fan of Van Morrison, but as a result of loving my husband, I now love Van Morrison. Okay, now, my point actually is, though, that parental love is more transitive. There's more of a tendency to love what your children love. So when I think back on my relationship with my son, it is kind of mind-boggling what I have come to love because he loves it. So when he was a child, I had an inordinate affection for Thomas the Tank Engine. Just makes no sense. So apart from my love for him, Captain Underpants. No, I mean, I loved it too much. It has to do with, I think it's the transitivity of loving somebody leads you to love what they love. Later on, it was just mysterious how much I came to love Eminem and Kanye West. And I even went to a Kanye West concert with my son, and I loved it. So I think parental love is especially transitive. Parental love is particularly lasting. Now, of course, with any of these things, you can find exceptions. But here's a quote from the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the Columbine killers. This is from the Andrew Solomon book, Far From the Tree. He has this very interesting chapter about the parents of serial killers. And he sort of, it's just kind of amazing how much the parents of serial killers remain committed to their children. So Dylan Klebold says, his mother says, "I know it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, but I believe it would not have been, better for me. Of myself, I'm glad I had kids, and glad I had the kids I did, because the love for them, even at the price of this pain, has been the single greatest joy of my life." You know, this is somebody whose child has done just completely horrific things, and she still loves him. Now, again, there are exceptions. So there was an interesting profile of Adam Lanza in the New Yorker last year, and the Sandy Hook killer, and his father said, I'm sorry he was ever born. So, I mean, there are cases like that, but my point is that parental love seems to be just particularly lasting. You know, people get divorced over things far more serious than than their partner turning out to be a serial killer. So there's a sort of durability to parental love. And then lastly, parental love keeps its intensity. Okay, now we want to believe, you know, romantic love also keeps its intensity, and maybe it does, and maybe it does for some people more than some other people, but I think it's just downright typical that parental love is super intense, you know, 20 years down the road. So for example, when I went to my kids' high school graduation, my twins who graduated last year, their high school graduate, there's sort of the exultation at an event like that. It's just, I think there's just very, very intense love there, you know, 18 years into the relationship. Okay, so parental love has all these striking features. So to compare parental love to romantic love, I'm now going to compare parental love to something just completely different. I'm going to compare parental love to self-love. Okay? I think parental love, as it turns out, when you kind of look into it, parental love is actually has more in common with self-love than with romantic love. So if you think of the three of them on a continuum, parental love is actually over on the self-love sort of end of the continuum. So here's why I think that. When you think about these features of parental love, those features are also found in self-love. So take, for example, first one that's particularly groundless. You know, you don't love your children because of their amazing attributes. Well, likewise, you don't love yourself because of your amazing attributes. You know, it's just, self-love is not really based on anything. I don't think people who are, like, real cool, you know, love themselves more than people who are just sort of ordinary. Parental love is particularly transitive. You love yourself, well, so you love what you love. I mean, it's, in a way, just completely vacuous to say that parental, that self-love is vacuous. Sorry, that self-love is transitive. But there's an interesting way in which sort of loving what you love is involves a kind of wholeheartedness that seems sort of intuitively, you know, connected to self-love. I said that parental love is particularly lasting. Well, so is self-love. Here you are, whatever at your age, whatever it is, and you still love yourself after all these years. Parental love keeps its intensity. So whatever it was like, you know, whatever it feels like, it still feels that way down the road. So self-love seems to be like that. Whatever the feeling of self-love, it has that same feeling 5 years later or 10 years later or whatever. So there's no sort of fading. Okay, so these features of parental love seem to kind of link it to self-love and more than to romantic love. Okay, so that's my story about the features of parental love. Groundlessness, very transitive, very lasting, keeps its intensity. And now I'm going to talk about why it has those features. So here's my explanation of those features. So why is parental love so much like self-love? Well, I'm going to kind of put forward just a really simple, obvious explanation that just makes perfect sense. It's because our children are like selves to their parents. Children really are selves. I mean, they're not literally selves. They're also separate. But when you love your child, it is very akin to loving yourself because your child is a sort of second self. Now, a lot of different people have said something like that. So I'm going to quote several people. Partly this is just a, you know, blatant appeal to authority. Partly it's just showing you I'm in company. Partly it's just these are nice, eloquent quotes. Okay, so let's start with Aristotle. Aristotle said, a parent then, this is from the Nicomachean Ethics, a parent then loves his children as he loves himself, for what has come from him is a sort of other self. So this just loves his children as he loves himself, for what has come from him is a sort of other self. Robert Nozick, the well-known philosopher, no longer with us, children themselves form part of one's substance. They form part of a wider identity you have. So, I mean, they're not literally you, that would be crazy, but they're sort of part of yourself. They sort of extend you. They're not entirely other. Charles Fried, a Harvard ethicist, parenthood is a kind of physical continuity which is also bound up with spiritual and moral continuity through our influence on our children. There's also a very nice passage in this book that talks about the idea that children are really, they are ourselves. They are sort of selves. They're second selves. They're separate from us, but they're self-like. So this is a common view. I think you also find it all over the place in just sort of ordinary folks talking about their children. There's this very well-known quote people sort of you see on the internet all the time about how having children is like having your heart walking around outside of your body. Or another place to go for this kind of thought is when you read about people having to give up their children for adoption. They talk about, you know, it was a part of me, you know, that was lost. But what do we really mean by this? So saying that your children are self-like, there's something kind of poetic about it, but, you know, and there's something kind of truthful, that's sort of illuminating, but what exactly am I saying? Let me try to make it a little bit more precise. One thing I'm saying is that children are self-like in a lot of different respects. So, for example, One of the things that characterizes your relationship with yourself is that you're not competitive with yourself. You know, you don't compete with a self. You don't compete with your children. So if your children, you know, beat you at tennis, you know, you're thrilled. If your children did better on the SATs, I think you're thrilled. I mean, I think we don't feel competitive with our children. We just want them to be great at whatever they do. Pride. You know, you take pride in your children's accomplishments in a way that's very hard to explain if they're just completely other people. Because does pride really make sense with respect to things that are, you know, you or yours? Likewise, shame. The way you feel if your kid screws up, it's just there's more intensity to the feeling or maybe even shame to it than really makes sense if the child is just somebody else. Identification. So, you know, whatever your child is doing, there's more of a sense that you're doing it than if it had been, you know, somebody else entirely. But feeling you have about wanting the child to survive, or the feeling that people have when they lose a child, you know, these feelings are so sort of singular that it makes you think there's something, there really is something self-like about a child. Okay, now to kind of dig into it a little bit more and say, well, why is a child self-like? I don't think it's just a matter of genes, because I don't think that a brother is nearly as self-like as a child or a sister, and yet there's a lot of genes that you share with your sibling. I also don't think it's just a question of that you created the child. Think about Frankenstein's relationship with his monster. You know, he created the monster. And that makes him feel kind of responsible for all the, you know, the monster's mayhem. But the just sheer creation, it doesn't really make the monster self-like. And so I don't think it's just creation that makes our children self-like. Okay, so what is it? So I think that Aristotle's right. I like his phrase when he says, for what has come from him is a sort of other self. It's the sheer fact that your children come from you, plus the way in which there are all these continuities involved when a child comes from you as opposed to being created like Frankenstein's monster. So just the sheer way that reproduction works makes it so that there are all these sort of physical and mental continuities between parent and child. And those continuities have something in common with the way in which a person's present self is related to their future self. So there, you know, what makes me at 80 still me, there's a lot of sort of physical and mental continuities. And you find not exactly the same continuities, but you find continuities linking parent and child. So that's not to say that, certainly not to say that children are like just truly ourselves, but it does sort of back up the idea that they are self-like. And so somebody who sees a child like that is not being irrational, or that's not a crazy view of children. Okay, so. So now we've got, you know, this idea that the features of love are parental love linked to self-love, and we've got an explanation of why that is, because children actually are sort of second selves, but separate. And now, so the third part of my talk is going to be assessment. So thinking about children this way, is it welcome? Is it worrisome? Is it sort of... is it helpful or is it dangerous? Is it good? Is it bad? Should we sort of affirm this story about the parent-child relationship? Is it useful? Is it explanatory? What is it? So make some kind of assessment. So I'm going to talk about six things that that appear to be problems with this picture, and I'm going to argue that none of these are really problems. I'm going to try to overcome all these different problems. Okay, so first apparent parent problem is that if parental love was a sort of self-love, then parental love wouldn't be admirable. You know, it would be, in fact, it might even be sort of deplorable. I mean, if you think of self-love as a bad thing, then kind of linking parental love to self-love, you know, makes parental love seem like a bad thing. So now I think the cure for this is just to kind of get over the idea that self-love is a bad thing. So I think self-love is not a bad thing. I think especially if you have a good theory about self-love and what it is, you can, it can be rehabilitated. So I mean, I think one of the nice things in this book is the third chapter, which is about self-love and which is a kind of defense of self-love as a good thing. And then furthermore, it just seems like, so even if self-love is not particularly, you know, it's not deplorable, but it's also probably not particularly admirable, it's just people feel self-love. So if parental love is a kind of self-love, and it's neither deplorable nor admirable, that seems okay, because I personally don't have any tremendous admiration for people just because they love their children. Well, of course they love their children. And I don't think that's like, I don't think that anybody's sort of claim to fame can be that they love their children, and of course they do. So I think sort of linking it to self-love and then making it seem just to be expected is really not a liability in this story. Okay, second apparent problem is that if you really see your child as second self, aren't you going to be just a horrible, domineering helicopter parent? I mean, isn't this kind of picture going to lead to bad parenting? Okay, so I don't think it's really true that this picture has to lead to bad parenting. Because if you think of your child as another self, or a second self, or a sort of self, you want that relationship to continue. And certainly if you sort of dominate and helicopter, that sort of puts that relationship in jeopardy. So a long-lasting relationship to a second self, you know, cannot be tyrannical. Now, to kind of bring out how it is that we actually sort of, there are constraints on how domineering you are towards another self, let me just talk a little bit about something different, which is how we get along with our very own selves. So, in a funny kind of way, we each of us need to kind of get along with our future selves. We need to not be too domineering towards our future selves, not be too, and also not let ourselves be dominated. So, to give you an example, I already gave this example in a to somebody. This is not going to be fresh material to Dawn, but. Okay, my little story about my daughter. My daughter, when she was 8 years old, decided she wanted to control her teenage self. She was worried that she would become a grumpy teenager. And so she started writing letters to her teenage self and about how don't be grumpy and, you know, try to have fun, you know. And she put all these letters in a box and put them in my closet. And then when she got to be 13 or 14, and I said, you know, it's time to open the box. Absolutely not. And she refused to ever open the box. And I think maybe what you could say there is that the 8-year-old was trying to control the 14-year-old, and the result of trying to control was a complete divorce. The 14-year-old just rejected the 8-year-old completely. I will not listen to you. I will not open the box. So I think if getting along with your own future self involves being kind of diplomatic and not too bossy, then, you know, a fortiori, as they say in Latin, getting along with your child has also got to involve not being too tyrannical. Now, one of the things that makes it easier to not be too tyrannical is the transitivity of love that I talked about before. So, loving somebody makes you love what they love. If you really love your child, you know, I think you will be open to what they love. And instead of getting mad that they're playing too much rap, you will actually enjoy it. I mean, instead of getting mad about their new interest in whatever it is, I think a really loving parent has can stretch in all sorts of different directions. So, and if you want a relationship with your children to be long-lasting, you had better be prepared to stretch, because, you know, like your future self can dump you, of course, your children can dump you, too. Okay, I'll see what else. Okay, and then last, another thing about that whole domineering versus, you know, helicopter parent kind of thing. Another thing is, I think that part of what enables us to kind of let children go off in the world without us hovering over them, it actually is that sort of sense of identification. And I found that this sort of little theory has been kind of tested this fall with my children being in college and being away from home for the first time. I've kind of wondered, how is this going to turn out? I mean, am I going to be able to, are all my little theories going to make any sense to me anymore? And so I've been kind of pleasantly surprised that you really are very happy with a child who's off on their own. I mean, the very fact that they are sort of thriving on their own does, it is so satisfying that it does kind of limit that desire to constantly interfere. And so I don't think that seeing your child, identifying strongly with your child necessarily turns you into a kind of smothering, you know, dominating parent. By the way, I checked this out with my daughter this afternoon. And I told her I was going to be talking about parental love, and checked out this theory about how I'm not really domineering and smothering, and she said, yes, you're right. She couldn't mind. Okay. Third parent problem is that when you see your child as a second self, it sort of spreads out your tendency toward partiality. So we each have this tendency to pursue our own interests, and if you see your child as another self, you're going to be partial towards your child as well. And of course, people just are partial towards their children. So for example, for the amount of money that we're spending, you know, sending our two kids to college, and we could probably buy, you know, elementary school education for, you know, 100 other kids. So, or, you know, dental care. For the amount you spend on braces, you could buy basic dental care for 10 kids. So there just is this partiality. And I guess the problem with this self story is that it validates it. It says that that's okay, because just as you prioritize yourself, it is to be expected that you will prioritize a child that you see as another self. Okay, so that sounds like a problem. But, you know, my reaction to that is, well, yes, it is a problem if there are children who don't have basic dental care and there are children who can't go to college. But we don't need to really solve that problem at the source. We don't have to kind of control parental love. We just need national health care, and we need graduated taxes, and we need things that create more equality, but not necessarily by sort of changing the nature of parental love. Fourth thing. So if we love our children as ourselves, and we sort of get this great satisfaction from raising them, that's practically, you know, that if their good feels to us like our own good, then there's really nothing self-sacrificing about parenthood. I mean, it's not an altruistic thing to do. And if it's not self-sacrificing, and you haven't sort of done all this great stuff for your kids, why should they come back and do anything for you? And so when you're old and you need their care, if you didn't sacrifice for them, if you didn't give up for them, but rather you did something very satisfying for yourself, then on what basis are they going to be able to, are you going to be able to demand, you know, anything in return? So I think that, in fact, that sort of thought might be, I think there's like an interesting contrast between this whole story about parenthood and a kind of a Confucian story on which parents really do make huge sacrifices for their children. So I think in Confucian thinking, the huge stress there is on filial piety and the idea that children owe enormous things to their parents. It is kind of bound up with the idea that parents have made a huge sacrifice, that parenthood is self-sacrificing rather than a question of, rather than a child being self-like. So I do, if I'm going to say that children are self-like to us, I do need to explain why they should stick around and do anything for us in our old age, because I'm not going to have that account that the Confucians rely on, which says that you sacrifice for them, now they owe you something in return. Okay, so we need an alternative story about why children should do anything for their parents, because we just don't have this sort of debt theory. And what I would say is that that, you know, when we think about why our children are going to do things for us when we're very old, it really isn't, they're not going to do things for us because they owe it to us. But that wouldn't be the only motivation they could have to begin with. So I think there's an alternative sort of motivation where kids do things for their elderly parents out of sort of sheer identification. And it arguably, just as children are self-like to their parents, it also goes the other way. Parents are also self-like to their children. So my experience of sort of taking care of my elderly father sort of bears this out. I do things for him on a daily basis. And I honestly, I can't say I ever think, well, he did all this stuff for me. I'm doing what I now owe him in return. You know, that just isn't the feeling at all. But instead, the feeling is that if he has a problem, it's my problem. If he, you know, loses his hearing aids again and can't hear, to me, it just feels immediately like, oh my God, you know, I can't hear. It's probably, there's just a very strong identification. So I think that kind of identification can account for, you know, why we are motivated to do things for our elderly parents, and we really don't need this story about how they sacrificed and, you know, and now we owe them. Okay, now, I have a fifth thing. I think that this story can explain all sorts of things that need to be explained. So, for example, there's, I think, some very deep puzzles about why people get to keep their children rather than children being sort of redistributed to be raised by the most capable, you know, to be raised in the best households. There are puzzles about why we get to share our values with our children, why we get to share our way of life rather than sort of reading textbooks on what is the very best way to raise children. There are puzzles about why we get to even have children in a world with a rising population. So there are lots and lots of puzzles about parenthood that I think are well explained by this story that children are second selves. But that's like all that's in my the book that I'm working. There's too much there to kind of go into, but let me just sort of allude to various problem-solving powers of this. Of this model, and then just talk about one last problem about seeing children as second selves. You might say that there's something just kind of unappealing about this picture. Here's a one last sentence from Frankfurt. Frankfurt says, parental love and self-love are similar in the practically inescapable power with which they naturally grip us. Well, it sounds kind of unpleasant to be gripped by an inescapable power. I mean, that sounds, whoa, you know, sort of, to be sort of gripped by self-love, that sounds unpleasant. To be gripped by parental love, that sounds. So, if there's a kind of inescapability of parental love, is that bad? Well, Frankfurt actually says, no, it's really not bad, because he compares the inescapability of parental love and self-love to the inescapability of logic and math. So there are lots of things in life that make you kind of, you're pulled this way and you're pulled that way. In fact, I think philosophy is just full of pulled this way, pulled that way. The beautiful thing about math is that 2 plus 2 equals 4. You know, just, it's restful. Frankfurt says it's very restful to just not be pulled in multiple directions. Just 2 plus 2 is 4. So he says that love gives us a kind of mathematical certainty. And in fact, when you just love yourself, there's a sort of restfulness to it. And likewise with loving your children. So if your children need something from you, you just have to do it. there's no wrestling. There's no ambivalence. Love can make us sort of wholehearted and resolute. And so that's not like having something external kind of controlling you, but it's a kind of a pleasant, restful, full steam ahead sort of a feeling. I just wanted to offer you a few footnotes. This book, The Reasons of Love by Harry Frankfurt, really good, very worth reading. Also, this talk is sort of based on a essay I wrote for the Philosopher's Magazine recently. Folks who are interested in philosophy and want to read sort of digestible philosophy, this magazine is, I highly recommend it. And anybody here familiar with the Philosopher's Magazine? Yeah, okay, so if you go online, it's just Google the Philosopher's Magazine, and it's just very accessible, very clearly written philosophy that is, you know, digestible for the public. And that's it. Questions? Points.
Why do I love my adopted son?
Okay, well, great question. There is a lot of stuff in this manuscript of mine about adoption. And so what I say is that there are actually many ways that a child can come from us. I think that the first way is biologically, so that if somebody biologically produces a child, they have, it's up to them to give up the child or not give up the child, so that there is that initial prerogative. But if they do give up the child, then I think the way that adoptive parents raise children creates a kind of coming from. It's not exactly the same kind of coming from, but you know, kids don't come from their fathers exactly the way they come from their mother. So there's already a kind of variety in the way that children come from parents. So I think adoptive parenthood does involve seeing your children as a second self and does even involve a kind of coming from. It's just not all exactly the same sort of coming from. So, you know, I don't mean, when I talk about it without mentioning adoption, I certainly don't mean to not include adoption. It's just that it's part of a bigger story.
I'm pretty loud. I'm like, that was my good. Is there any link between people without self-love and an abusive child? A child that's maybe abused or neglected? If you don't love yourself, you're obviously not going to love the child.
Yeah.
Not in the way that you're. There may be a possession to it.
Yeah.
Do you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah.
Could that be an explanation
maybe.
For?
I mean, Frankfurt has all sorts of interesting things to say about self-love. So he says that, you know, we don't all just sort of automatically love ourselves, and we don't all love ourselves equally. So there is a kind of development of self-love. And what he says is that to develop self-love is to, actually it sounds very vacuous, but it's to come to really love what you love. The contrast is with somebody who love something but also hates it. So for example, if you're on Facebook all day and you really enjoy it but you kind of hate it, then that's not, that lacks that kind of wholeheartedness. That is a person who doesn't love themselves entirely. Or if you're sort of pulled in multiple directions, you want to do this but you you know, but you want to do that. So you can't ever really get to a sense of wholeheartedness about your goals. That is, according to Frankfurt, shows a kind of lack of self-love. So I suppose somebody who who's like that and sort of constantly, I love, you know, my drugs, but I hate my drugs, or I love my husband, but he's abusing me, and I hate my husband. I mean, that kind of being torn in a million ways and failing to be sort of resolute. It could be that state of mind is linked to sort of failures of parental love as well. But I mean, I guess that would be, that's just sort of a conceptual possibility. I mean, we would need to have some empirical evidence before really saying that.
Self-love might be more understandable as self-interest. And in the extreme, we have a word for it, narcissism. Self without boundaries to everyone's detriment. Is there a corresponding narcissistic form of parental love?
Well, first of all, I don't think self-love is simply the same thing as self-interest. You know, I think self-love, there's a little more emotion to it, a little more this whole notion of being undivided, you know, resolute, wholehearted. You know, those are all things that, those are all features of self-love that go beyond just self-interest. And sort of narcissistic, I mean, that's a very pejorative term for self-love. So I think that sort of the redemption of self-love is sort of partly what I'm arguing for here. But self-love is actually okay. Now, I guess, yes, there's such a thing as sort of bad self-love where it is narcissistic. And so I wouldn't want to, deny that. So sort of likewise, there's presumably sort of bad parental love. So, you know, maybe these sort of... the person who isn't thinking the long term and is sort of smothering their child is experiencing bad parental love. So, for example, somebody who, you know, I'm a lawyer, so my kid has to be a lawyer, who just truly thinks of their child as a clone of themselves, you know, that's bad parental love. I think it would be good to have it's probably good for me to have some kind of a, it would be good to sort of think about the bad forms as well as the good forms of parental love.
Can you talk a little bit more about the parents typically don't have the need to compete with their children and the parents that actually do have that need to compete with their children, or for example, they're not happy when their children do well.
Uh-huh.
Kind of the opposite. If they are doing well or good grades or getting a raise or buy a new house, it's very off-putting to the parent.
Uh-huh.
What can you say about that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't really have anything to say about it. I mean, I guess it's just true that there are exceptions to this general picture that I'm drawing. There are sort of pathologies and, you know, and exceptions and so on and so forth. So I'm certainly not committed to the idea that every single person who has a child has all of these, this entire state of mind. But it does seem to me to be very typical of parents to be non-competitive with their children. All of these things have their exceptions, have these sort of heart-wrenching exceptions. I think maybe one thing I would just say is that when a parent is competitive with a child, doesn't it seem weird?
Thanks.
I mean,
it does seem weird. Once you're outside the home and realize, this is strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you're in that environment growing up, as we all experience. Yeah. You don't realize anything is odd or off until you have something to compare it to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is odd. It's anomalous, sort of a strange attitude to have. I mean, but I'm not saying it's unheard of, you know. So, but it does seem very strange, you know, which seems to kind of confirm the idea that, you know, parents, typically children are self-like to their parents. So that's why it's so strange for a parent to be competitive with their child, and instead of sort of taking pride in the child's accomplishments. It sort of seems... Yeah, it's...
Parents are competitive with children many times for teaching them home skills they learn in their competitive world. And if you look at it that way, where the child begins to challenge the love that they're allowed, and the parent appears to be being competitive, but learning to argue.
Yeah, well, arguing is fantastic. I mean, I'm all for arguing. Let's argue.
Kids have to learn how to.
Yeah, oh, sure.
And if they don't have someone to argue with.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, just arguing and, you know, competition in sport. I don't mean that parents are not. I mean, if I play a card game with my kids, I'm going to win. You know? Why not? I mean, I have no problem with that whatsoever. All I mean is, like, if your child does better at something than you do, you know, they get into a college that you could not get into, or they're really great at a sport that you're not great at, or whatever. I find that a very unusual, you know, it seems unusual to me for a parent to feel anything but proud of that.
Well, the parent could be showing how the child's going to have to deal with their friends.
Yeah.
They're going to show disappointment. Envy and jealousy.
Yeah.
And so a parent who shows a little bit of that in a comfortable setting,
As a kind of a learning experience or something, I can sort of see that. But to truly to feel intimidated by your own child, I'm just sheltered or something. But I have not seen that. And I mean, I've been around a lot of parents. I don't feel as if I've seen that much.
Yeah, but I haven't seen that.
Much. Yeah.
To add on the competition thing, could that be more male-oriented? I mean, I got two boys. I play basketball. I play to win.
You know, yeah, beat me, sure.
I'll high five.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, could that be a male-oriented type of thing?
Yeah, but you just said you high five them. I mean, yeah. you're happy.
We're competitive.
Yeah.
Could it be
so I don't mean that parents are not competitive in the sense of enjoying a game or enjoying
I mean, even at a deeper level, like you brought up the college.
Yeah.
Could it be more male versus female, whereas males may be more competitive even on the more important things? Males are competitive mostly. Genetically, just predisposition to be that way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm always just sort of giving my picture of parenthood by, you know, talking to people or reading little things, reading novels. And I mean, what comes to my mind is a New York Times column by a guy named Michael Weinrich, I think is his name. I can't remember. And it's about, I remember sort of a passage in that article about how much this guy loves being beaten at tennis by his kids. I mean, I don't know. Just seems I would be surprised if men don't. I think my theory of it is men identify with their sons so much that for my son to go out, you know, for your son to go out there and be fantastic at something, it's almost as if it's you're going out there and being fantastic at that thing. So if he beats you, it's like you're being beaten by your own self. It's okay. You're happy. You get to celebrate all of his points, and you get to celebrate your own points as well. It's a win-win situation.
Yeah, one thing I'm curious about, because I haven't heard you say very much about it, but I would
think that evolutionary development would be a major reason for parental love.
Yeah.
I'm just curious why that was not really a major part of what you had to say.
Well, okay, one reason why it's not a major part is because when you look at other species, parental love takes all sorts of forms. So in lots of species, once the child is mature, they just leave, and that's it. The parent never sees the child again, like the emperor penguins, you know. At the end of the 6 months or whatever it is, the kids just dive off into the sea and bye-bye, you know. It's just... And it just seems like, and then there are other species where, you know, wolf packs where only the alpha males, you know, reproduce. And there are species where, you can see anything in animal species. So it doesn't seem like just the sheer biology of reproduction tells us much about parenthood. Now, of course, there's the biology of human reproduction. I wouldn't say it's irrelevant. I'm certainly not irrelevant. So I guess I don't really mean to be saying anything that's really in competition with a biological story about how reproduction works. But yeah,
I think there's a lot more.
What?
You just think there's a lot more.
And also, I guess cross-culturally, I mean, there are differences between the way different groups reproduce. But I guess I'm kind of going for a certain core to reproduction that we can talk about a little bit more illuminatingly in philosophical terms rather than in biological terms. But. I should probably think about that more. I should have a better answer to that, because I'm certainly I read biology and interest in biology. I'm all for the idea that there are biological aspects to the way that we relate to our children. But I haven't I've decided I'm talking about this at just on a higher level, but not meaning to exclude a lower level.
Okay. If there are no more questions, we'll conclude and thank our speaker one more time.